Part 1. Dreams of the Red Chamber. Chapter 1. Through the petrified forests of Uttarakhand and the barren rad wastes of Uttar Pradesh, the travellers climbed. Then through the Brahmaputra Valley, drawing closer to the roof of the world with every passing day. Onto the Terai Dua flatlands, now colonized by the shipwrights of the Mechanicum for their dry dock repair yards. Through those acetylene-lit cathedrals of iron, they rose still higher, into the thin air of the Baba, where the land was cut with collimated stream beds that had once carried meltwater from the highest peaks to the plains below. Vast swathes of subtropical forest had once flourished here, before ancient wars had destroyed almost everything living on the surface of the world. Oceans had boiled, continents burned, and so much of what made this land special had been lost in those wars. But the world had endured. This particular forest had been dominated by the Saja, a tree favoured by an ancient god of a long-dead empire that had once dominated the lands hereabouts. One of the few surviving myths of that empire was that its greatest queen had given birth to a mortal god while gripping the branches of a Saja tree in a village of the Sakyans. This god had spawned a new religion, but nothing now remained of his teachings, and no tales told whether he had been a wrathful or benevolent god. The travellers knew nothing of the region's history, for Baba was now a desolate hinterland of sprawling worker camps that filled the landscape as far as the eye could see. Millions of craftsmen, labourers and hulking migao gathered together in industrious cities of canvas and prefabricated plasteel, the raw meat and muscle driving the engine of construction that now enveloped the farthest reaches of the mountains. Higher still, into the Shivalik belt of upland rock, where the travellers rested overnight in the statue-lined Chitwan processional, before making the push through the Mohan Pass into the Mahabharat Lek, where the first of the great gates reared from the titanic peaks like a sepulchral portal into the lair of a sleeping giant. This was the Primus Gate, and in more peaceful times, the sunlight had made the damascene silver and lapis lazuli coffers shine like dew on the morning of the very first day in creation. Those coffers were now obscured by adamantium panels. The exquisite lapidary that had been a traveller's first sight of the Emperor's palace now locked away in secure vaults. Towering cranes and bulk lifters sprouted from its battlements, and cascades of sparks fell from phosphor-tipped welding torches. Thousands of petitioners and supplicants gathered before the gate, patiently waiting their turn to pass through its towering magnificence. Not all would reach the lofty heart of the palace. The climb would prove to be too arduous for many, the journey too long, or the wonders too great to bear. A phalanx of soldiers in gleaming breastplates of ivory and jade kept watch on the petitioners, and the air was charged with frightening strangeness. A lone figure, armoured in all-encasing gold plate, moved through the crowds, and the crimson of his helm's horsehair plume stood out like a bloodstain on snow. Never before had the Primus Gate been shut, and the stark fact of its closure struck a clear note that the axis of the galaxy had tilted. Humanity had a new enemy, one that wore a familiar face and whose agents might even now be among them. No longer could Terra's citizens walk freely within the domain of their master. Until now, the traveller's journey into the peaks had been largely unhindered by the rigorous new security that surrounded the continental palace of the Emperor. But they had drawn too near the bright flame at the heart of the Imperium to pass unnoticed. Millions of migrant workers had come to the palace, and so many faces needed watching. As it transpired, the Primus Gate was traversed without much in the way of inconvenience, for they had come with documents affixed with the seal of one of the great navigator houses, and its amethyst hue was given due deference by the gate's castellans as the way was opened. Passing beneath its shadow took many hours of travel, and once beyond the gate, the magnificence of the palace proper began. It had been described as a crown of lights atop the world, a continental landmass of unrivaled architectural brilliance and the greatest work of man. But such descriptions failed to capture its epic immensity, the sheer weight of awe it engendered, and the colossal impossibility of its very existence. Many supplicants who had spent their life's worth to see the palace passed its first gate and climbed no further, humbled to the point of insensibility by even its least noteworthy avenues, processionals and towers. It was a monumental endeavour, built not to the scale of men, but the scale of gods. Beyond the docking rings and landing fields of the Brahmaputra plateau rose the tallest peaks, the naked mountain, the great black, the turquoise goddess, and, once mightiest of them all, the Holy Mother. None of them had escaped the attentions of the Mechanicum or the Emperor's war masons. Their summits planed flat, and their bedrock burrowed deep to anchor the footings of the mighty palace.
"Impressive," said Balan Tortega from the back of the luxurious up-armoured skimmer.
Kai Zulane fixed the Chirurgeon with a hostile stare.
"I hate you," he said.
The interior of the skimmer was panelled with off-world wood from the broadleaf forests of Yolu, its metallic surfaces edged with chased platinum and inset with smooth picked slates that displayed a rolling series of serene alien landscapes. The seats were plush amethyst velveteen, with the crest of House Castana embroidered in gold. Subtle lighting kept the hard edges of the interior soft, and a well-stocked chill bar meant even a long journey could pass in comfort. All that spoiled the elegant luxury of the interior was the presence of four House Castana armsmen. Clad in loops of gleaming black carapace and bonded leather armour, they filled the interior of the skimmer with their augmented physiques. Castana was preeminent among the families of the Navis nobility, and could easily afford the ruinous cost of Mechanicum enhancements for their security personnel. Their faces were invisible behind glossy black helm visors, and each was wired with crystalline side dampers, as was the skimmer itself, to shield them from psychic intrusion. Ostensibly, these men were here as a protective escort, but the combat shotguns gripped tightly in heavy leather gauntlets left no doubt in Kai's mind that he was little better than a prisoner. He eased his back into the wide seat, finding himself unable to enjoy comfort he had once taken for granted. He cradled a glass of mahogany-coloured amasek, swirling the drink in a cut crystal glass that would cost more than most citizens would earn in a year. Idly, he thought of throwing the glass out the window, but decided that such petty rebellion would only irritate him afterwards. Besides, the liquor dulled the ache of sigh sickness that had plagued him since his return to Terra. Across from Kai, Balan Tortega stared out of the window with open-mouthed delight. It was the Chirurgeon's first time visiting the palace, and it showed. He had been naming landmarks and marvelling at the sheer number of people within the palace precincts ever since they had passed beneath the Primus Gate nearly 20 hours ago. Their route took them over the Brahmaputra plateau, and Kai kept an artfully bored expression glued to his face. He knew it was an honour to see the cradle of humanity up close, but was too wrapped in his own misery to take much notice of his surroundings.
"I believe that covered amphitheatre, the one encased in scaffolding, is the investory,"
said Tortega. The statues of the Primarchs within are hooded with mourning shrouds.
Why?
Asked Kai.
What do you mean?
I mean, why hood a statue? It's not like it can see.
It's symbolic, Kai, said Tortega. It represents the desire of the Emperor to shield his sons from the treachery of their brothers.
Represents a waste of time, if you ask me. I would have thought the Emperor had more to worry about than pointless symbolism.
Tortega sighed.
You know your biggest problem, Kai.
I am well aware of my problems, good Kyrurgeon, snapped Kai. You never tire of reminding me of them every day.
You take no appreciation of how lucky you are,
said Tortega, as if Kai hadn't spoken. Kai bit back a caustic response and took another drink.
Patriarch Verducina would have been well within his rights to have cast you out of the Telepathica. And then what would you have done? You'd have been picked up by the Psi-hounds within a day.
Kai used to try and diffuse these lectures while in the Medicae facilities of House Castana on the island crag of Kyprios. But time and apathy had made him realise that once Tortega had begun, there was no stopping him.
You think you could have afforded those ocular augmetics without the Castanas?
Continued Tortega.
Disgrace the house and they'll take them back, mark my words. You have a lot to be thankful for, young man, and it's time you realise that before it's too late.
It's already too late, said Kai. Look where we are. Where I'm going.
We're in the bosom of our species, Kai. And when the Imperium is reunited after this silly war, people will flock to this place,
said Tortega, leaning forward and placing a hand on Kai's knee. The sensation was painful, and Kai flinched at the Kyrurgeon's unwarranted overfamiliarity.
Don't touch me, said Kai. Don't you know anything about telepaths? Do you really want me to know all your dirty little secrets?
Tortega snatched his hand back and Kai shook his head.
Idiot. I've no talent for psychometry. But you were worried, weren't you? What are you keeping from old Verducina? Drug abuse? Illicit liaisons with your patients? Aberrant sexual deviancy?
The Kyrurgeon reddened and Kai laughed.
You're a pathetic little man, Tortega. You think Verducina values you? Likes you? You're nothing to him. Just another disposable functionary. That is, if he even knows your name.
Tortega's back stiffened, but he refrained from rising to Kai's bait. Instead, he returned his gaze to the wonders passing their skimmer.
There,
said Tortega archly.
That's the Hamazan Ossuary. I've seen Picts, but they don't capture the grandeur of its scale. You really have to see it to appreciate the harmony of its proportions. And there, I believe, that colonnaded archway with the golden finials and weeping domes leads to the Astartes Tower. They say it's the last place the Emperor and the Primarch spoke before the expedition fleet set off to the far corners of the Imperium. The glorious arias of Kinska's The Score of Heroes tells of each day the Emperor spent with his sons.
I'll bet he wishes he'd spent longer,
said Kai idly, finishing his drink and placing the glass on the polished mahogany rest beside him. He wanted another, to drain the entire bottle. Anything to dull the ache.
What do you mean?
Said Tortega.
Maybe if the Emperor had spent longer than a day with Horus Lupercal, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Hush,
said Tortega.
You cannot say such things, not here, not in this place.
Who is to stop me?
Tortega shook his head.
What pleasure do you get from being so provocative?
Kai shrugged.
I was just pointing out that had the Emperor spent more time with his Primarchs, then perhaps they might not have turned on him. It's hardly a treasonous thought.
Who is to say what is treason these days?
Sighed Tortega.
Just ask the Crusader host, said Kai. I'm pretty sure they could tell you.
It took another day to reach their destination, and Tortega spent his time cataloguing wonders of the palace he would probably never see again. The Gallery of Winter, Upanishad's tomb, the Petitioner's Hall, the Crystal Observatory, the fire-blackened preceptory, the Long Room and the Forge of Flesh and Steel, where the historic pact between the Martian priesthood and Terra had finally been sealed. Its double-headed eagle capstone was fashioned from auslite and porphyry. In the dying sunset, it looked bloody. Kai sensed the presence of the City of Sight long before he saw it over the horizon, a grimly empty space amid this teeming anthill of mental activity. The side dampers fitted to the skimmer had blocked virtually every stray thought from the billions of workers, labourers, scribes, technicians, artisans and soldiers within the palace walls. But Kai had still sensed the background thrum of so vast a populace. Approaching the headquarters of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica, there was nothing, no trace that anyone lived in this forsaken part of the palace. Kai knew better, having spent nearly a decade within its bleak towers, learning how to harness his abilities for the betterment of the Imperium. Thinking back to those days, he felt a fleeting touch of nostalgia, but quelled it bitterly, for this was no joyous homecoming. Where other regions of the palace were celebrations of unity, the builders of the City of Sight seemed to have gone out of their way to craft something calculated to weigh on the soul. Beyond the domain of the astrotelepaths, the architecture of the palace was raised up in glorification of mankind's achievements, its statuary fashioned to remind a grateful populace of all that had been rebuilt in the wake of the terrible, world-spanning wars that had almost dragged the species down into extinction. None of that was to be found in the City of Sight, and Kai felt only aching despair as the skimmer passed beneath the obsidian arch in its outer walls. Tortega twisted his head as he stared at the forest of iron towers, lightless garrets and silent thoroughfares within. The streets of the palace beyond the glossy black archway were alive with the heaving, vibrant mass of humanity. But only solitary ghosts in hooded green robes populated these streets.
"A lot of memories here for you, I expect," said Tortega.
Kai nodded and said,
"I really hate you."
It was foolish to be out on the streets this late, but Roxanne had little choice but to risk the darkness. Though it was night, the Petitioner's City was never truly dark. Drum fires cast flickering illumination on the walls of the buildings around her, and hooded lanterns hung from hooks on makeshift lamplighter posts. Fumes from chemical burners clung to leaning structures built from prefabricated panels stolen from the spoil heaps of the Mechanicum or the construction fields before the palace walls. Whip antennae reached up into the smoky haze hanging over the ad hoc city from some of the larger dwellings, and cloth bunting was strung from corner to corner in a failed effort to leaven the appearance of squalor. The wall next to her was plastered with Lectitio Divinitatus flyers, crudely printed on old propaganda sheets. Roxanne's every instinct had counseled against her leaving the temple, but the sight of Maya's crying children had persuaded her that there was no other option. The infections ravaging their tiny frames were well advanced, and without medicine they would be dead by morning. Two of Maya's offspring were already laid at the feet of the vacant angel, while their mother wept and wailed to its featureless face. Paladis had given her directions to the Serpent House, and Roxanne took care to follow them exactly. She had never travelled so far from the temple, and the experience was fearful and exciting in the same breath. To a girl raised a virtual prisoner by her own family, the sense of danger was liberating and intoxicating. And just as the city was never truly dark, nor was it ever truly silent. Metal hammered on metal. Children cried. Mothers shouted. Lunatic preachers read their holy writ of the emperor, and drunks yelled obscenities at the air. Roxanne had read volumes of history in the family library that spoke of old earth cities, how they had been teeming slums where millions of people lived cheek by jowl with one another in appalling poverty. That, her carefully vetted tutors told her, had been an ancient age, an age before the coming of the emperor. To Roxanne's freshly opened eyes, it didn't look like much had changed. It seemed absurd that poverty like this could exist in the shadow of the palace, the living symbol of this new age of progress and enlightenment. The gilded halo around the palace bathed the tallest buildings of heroic architects with lambent illumination, but little hint of the light and wonder the Emperor's armies were bringing to the galaxy fell upon the petitioner's city. Roxanne wondered if her family had sent anyone to find her, if there were, even now, agents of her father scouring the streets of the city, looking for his wayward daughter. Perhaps, but most likely not. The dust had yet to settle from the scandal surrounding her last voyage, and she imagined there would be those amongst the family hierarchy who would be more than happy to see her lost amongst the faceless masses. She put such thoughts from her mind and concentrated on the route ahead. Dangerous enough to roam the streets of the city this late without letting her mind dwell on the injustices of the world or the life on which she had turned her back. This was her life now, and it was about as far from the one she had known as it was possible to get. Swathed in a hooded robe of rough, muddy brown fabric that Roxanne wouldn't have dreamed of wearing a few months ago, she was an innocuous enough presence on the streets. The few people she passed carefully avoided her glances and made their own furtive ways through the streets. She kept her hood pulled tight around her head, keeping her features in the shadows and walking with the hunched gait common amongst the city's inhabitants. The less notice she attracted, the better. The Serpent House was deep into Kaal territory, and she most assuredly did not want to run into any of the Babu's men before she got there. At best, they would kill her quickly and rob her. At worst, they'd take their time in violating her before dumping the mutilated corpse in the gutter. Roxanne had seen the body of a girl who'd run into Gota, the Babu's most feared enforcer, and she found it impossible to comprehend that a human being could do such terrible things. The girl's father had brought her to the temple and handed over everything he owned. Paladis had tried to stop the man leaving, knowing full well where he would go, but the father's grief was unassailable. His dismembered body had been found hanging from iron meat hooks on the edge of the Dakal territories the following night. Yes, it was dangerous to be out in the petitioner's city after sundown, but Maya's little ones needed counterbiotics, and Antioch was the only chirurgeon who had medicine that hadn't been cut with too many impurities to do any good. The old man's prices were ruinous, but that didn't matter to Paladis when it came to children. In any case, what price could you put on a life when the temple was never short of money? The bereaved were generous with their coin, as though fearing any hint of pecuniary reticence would somehow prevent their dead from finding peace. Imperial truth owned to no life beyond the corporeal, that death was the end of a person's journey. But Roxanne knew better. She had stared into the tenebrous realm that lay beyond the hideously permeable borders of reality, and seen things that made her question everything she had been told. She shook off such dangerous thoughts, feeling her breath quicken and her heartbeat race. Suppressed memories threatened to surface, horrors of skinless bodies on fire from the marrow, wet organs hanging from ruptured torsos, and skulls licked clean from the inside. But she fought to quell them by fixing on something inconsequential. The wall next to her was daubed with graffiti, and she focused the entirety of her attention upon it as her memory recalled the smell of blood and the ozone stink of failing shields. It was a mural depicting hulking warriors of the Legiones Astartes atop newly conquered worlds, gaudy in colour and robust in vigour, if not aesthetic merit. The artist was clearly ignorant of their true scale, as the armoured figures were not much bigger than the mortal soldiers accompanying them. Roxanne had seen the terrible might of the Legiones Astartes and knew just how unnaturally swollen they were, their bulk freakishly ogre-like, yet surprisingly supple and graceful. The mural had been vandalised, and several of the figures were partially obscured with hurled whitewash and slogans that reassuringly told her that the Emperor protected. The purple of the Emperor's children and the blue of the World Eaters was almost completely gone, while the white and ochre green of the Death Guard poked out from numerous angry brushstrokes. A lunar wolf howled from behind a wide splash of paint, while an iron warrior's face had been unfairly hacked from the wall and lay in pieces on the hard-packed earth. Roxanne's breathing slowed, and she reached out to touch the mural, letting the reassuring solidity of the wall bring her back to a place of equilibrium. She closed her eyes and rested her forehead against the rough brickwork, taking in slow breaths and imagining the expanse of an empty desert wasteland. The metallic reek of innards faded, and the pungent odour of roasting meat and stale sweat returned with its all-too-human aroma. The toxic smell of backsticks waxed strong in the mix. "In the desert, there is no life," she said, repeating the mantra her tutors had taught her so long ago. "In the desert, I am alone, and nothing can touch me. I am inviolate."
"Too bad you're far from a desert, little girl," grunted a voice behind her.
Roxanne turned in fright, all thoughts of equilibrium and deserts falling from her mind like leaves in autumn. Three men in heavy furs and rough canvas work overalls lounged on the wall opposite the mural. All three smoked, and clouds of blue hung like a fog over their heads. Swarthy and rough-skinned, they were brutish and clumsy-looking. But Roxanne knew better than to dismiss them as common drunks or thugs.
"I am not looking for trouble," said Roxanne, lifting her hands, palm up, towards the men.
They laughed, and a man with thin eyes and a long, drooping moustache stepped forward. He flicked his backstick away.
"That's too bad, little girl, because trouble's found you."
"Please," said Roxanne, "if you are Babu Dakal's men, you should walk away. It would be better for everyone if you just left me alone. Trust me."
"If you know we work for the Babu, then you know we're not going to let you go," said the man, beckoning his companions to his side.
Roxanne saw heavy pistols stuffed into the waistbands of their overalls and crude handmade shanks strapped to their thighs. The mustachioed leader pulled a gleaming weapon from his belt, a long knife with the blade angled forward. He lifted it to his lips and ran a yellowed tongue over the cutting edge of the knife. Blood dripped down his chin and he smiled, exposing reddened teeth.
"You're from the Death Church, aren't you?" said the man.
"I am from the Temple of Woe, yes," confirmed Roxanne,
keeping her voice as neutral as possible.
"That is why you should leave me alone."
"Too late for that, little girl. I'm guessing you're heading for Antioch, and that means you must have plenty of coin to afford his prices. Hand it over now, and we'll go easy on you. Maybe only cut you a little."
"I cannot do that," said Roxanne.
"Of course you can. Just reach inside that robe and hand it over. Trust me, it'll be easier for you if you do. Anil and Murat aren't kind like I am, and they already want to kill you."
"If you take my money, you will be killing two children," explained Roxanne.
The man shrugged.
They won't be the first. I doubt they'll be the last.
With a gesture, the two men either side of the lead thug rushed towards her. She turned and ran for the end of the road, screaming for help, though she knew no one would answer. A hand grabbed her robe. She squirmed free. A fist punched her on the shoulder and she stumbled, reaching out to the wall to steady herself. A portion of the adobe wall came loose and she cried out as she fell to her knees. She found herself face to face with a piece of brickwork bearing the helm of a warrior in armour of red and white. A foot planted itself between her shoulder blades and shoved hard. Roxanne's face slammed into the earthen street and blood filled her mouth as she bit the inside of her cheek. Rough hands rolled her onto her back. Roxanne's hood fell back along with a knotted bandana and her assailant leered a gap-toothed grin.
"Pretty, pretty,"
he spat. His shank caught the light of a nearby torch. A second pair of hands tore open her robe and Roxanne thrashed in their grip.
"Get off me!"
she screamed, but Babu Dakal's men weren't listening.
"I warned you,"
said the leader of the thugs almost amiably.
"No,"
said Roxanne.
"I warned you!"
The thug, pawing at her belt, suddenly spasmed as though a high-voltage electric current was passing through him. Blood-flecked froth burst from behind his teeth, and his eyes boiled to glutinous steam within their sockets. He screamed and rolled off Roxanne, clawing at his smoking skull and thrashing as though assaulted by a host of invisible attackers.
"What did you do?"
snarled the second man, scrambling away in terror. Roxanne sat up and spat a broken tooth, her anger and hurt too powerful for any thoughts of mercy to intrude. She fixed the frightened man with her gaze and once again did the very thing her tutors had always warned her never to do. The man screamed and bright red blood squirted from his nose and ears. The life went out of him in an instant and he slumped against the wall like a drunk. Roxanne climbed unsteadily to her feet as the third man backed away from her in horror.
"You are Boxy!"
cried the man.
"A demon witch!"
"I told you to leave me alone," said Roxanne. "But you wouldn't listen!"
"I'll kill you!"
screamed the man, reaching for his pistol. Before the weapon cleared his overalls, he fell back with sizzling brain matter leaking from every orifice in his skull. Without a sound, he toppled sideways and his head caved in like an emptied air bladder as it hit the ground. Roxanne steadied herself against the wall behind her, breathless and appalled at the violence she had unleashed. Swiftly, she retrieved her bandana and pulled up the hood of her robe, lest anyone see her face and recognize her for what she was. Once again, blood and death had followed her. She was what ancient mariners had once called a Jonah, and it seemed that no matter where she hid, ill fortune and death would surround her. She hadn't meant to kill these men, but raw survival instinct had kicked in, and there was little she could have done to prevent their deaths. She saw the clan markings tattooed on the arm of the man she had killed first, and the cold realization of what she had done flooded her. These were Babu Dakal's men. He would demand blood in return for their deaths. And the Babu was not a man given to restraint in his vengeance. When retaliation came, it would be exponentially worse.
"Throne, what have I done?"
she whispered. Roxanne fled into the night. The skimmer eased through the city of sight, its blue and amethyst colours bright in the overlong shadows that filled its gloomy precincts. Few statues were raised here, and though many of the pale, columned buildings were grandly shaped and heroically proportioned, they were brooding, monolithic structures that pressed down on the skin of the mountains like architectural black holes, sucking in the available light and warmth of the failing day. Kai knew he was being melodramatic, a trait he despised in others, but couldn't help himself from such indulgence. He had long thought himself done with this bleak place, but here he was again, cast back like a failed aspirant.
The image was an apt one, he realized, for wasn't that exactly what he was? The hollow mountain loomed above the city, casting its shadow over Kai. Though he affected an air of disinterest, the idea of being taken there sent breathless jolts of fear through his body. He pushed thoughts of that dreadful place from his mind and concentrated on the road ahead. Tortega had turned away from the window, proving that even a fool could sense the weight of solemnity that pervaded the city of sight. Kai reached out with the tiniest measure of his psychic senses to determine exactly where he was. Thanks to his augmetic eyes, precision-fashioned ocular implants, ground and crafted by Mechanicum adepts, bonded to House Castana, he had little reason to employ his blindsight, and it took a moment for him to adjust his perceptions from visual to psychic. He closed his eyes, feeling the weight of the nearby buildings and the etheric bulk of the many high towers of Psychers. It took a moment to orient himself, but in seconds he had shaped the surrounding architecture into ribbons of light and gleaming threads of colour. The skimmer was passing the Gallery of Mirrors, a vast cathedral-like building through which successful initiates passed on their way to the awe-inspiring caverns beneath the city. Far beneath the palace, they would kneel before the Emperor and have the impossibly complex neural pathways of their mind agonizingly reshaped to better resist the dangers of the warp. Kai remembered being shepherded through the gallery by a company of black sentinels, nervous, excited, and unsure of what was to come. He supposed the mirrors were there to give the aspirants a last look at their faces before their eyes were seared from their sockets by a force so potent it was beyond imagining. In the years since Kai had taken that walk, he had never been able to decide if that was merciful or cruel. He shook off the memory, unwilling to relive such a singular moment in the presence of those who would misread his pained expression as fear of where they were going. Instead, he cast his mind sense forward, along the flat plain of the road towards the tallest tower of the city. Alone of all the structures around it, the Whispering Tower shone with a lattice of silver light, though it was a light that existed beyond the sight of most mortals. Yet for all its brightness, its glow was eclipsed utterly by the burning lance of light that speared from the hollow mountain. That brilliance was of another order of magnitude entirely, and Kai was able to tune it out of his perceptions only with difficulty.
"Why are there no telepaths on the streets?" asked Tortega. "I'm only seeing servitors, Sherpa couriers and a few Mechanicum thralls."
Kai opened his eyes, and the cityscape of light and colour vanished from his mind, replaced with the prosaic geometry of its mundane stones and stolid angles. Though he had jumped at the chance to have his sight restored, it was at moments like this he almost wished he had not.
"The students and adepts of the Telepathica mostly travel by means of a network of tunnels and crossways, cut into the rock beneath the city. Very few come above ground if they can help it."
"Why is that?"
Kai shrugged.
"Feeling sunlight on your skin is just another reminder of what you've lost."
"Of course. I see,"
nodded Tortega, as though grasping some complex insight into the human psyche, instead of something that should have been obvious.
"The city walls and the rock below us are threaded with psi-disruptive crystals, which makes it quieter too," said Kai. "Travelling above ground is noisy for an astropath. You keep hearing undisciplined thoughts, random chatter and wild emotions. You're taught to tune it out, of course, but it's always there in the background. It's just easier to travel where you don't hear it."
"Are you hearing anything now?"
"Just your incessant prattle," said Kai.
Tortega sighed.
"Your hostility is just a defence mechanism, Kai. Let it go."
"Spare me," said Kai,
resting his head on the soft fabric of the headrest and closing his eyes. His blind sight picked out the shimmering glow of the Whispering Tower and the minds that waited at its entrance. One was welcoming, while the other bristled with hostility not even a shielded helmet could contain. The skimmer glided to a halt, and the batwing doors hissed as they swooped up with a hiss of high-end pneumatics. Three of the armsmen climbed from the skimmer, while the fourth gestured to Kai and Tortega to disembark with a curt swipe of his shotgun barrel. Tortega hurriedly got out, but Kai poured himself another measure of Amasek, taking his time and delaying his inevitable fate as long as possible.
"Get out," said the armsman.
"One last drink," said Kai. "Trust me, they don't have anything like this good in there."
He drained the glass in one swallow and coughed as the liquor set his throat on fire.
"You done?"
asked the blank visor across from him.
"So it would appear," said Kai,
lifting the bottle from the chill bar and tucking it under his arm as he climbed from the comfortable warmth of the skimmer. The freezing air of the mountains hit him like a blow, and he took a frigid breath that burned his throat more thoroughly than the Amasek. He'd forgotten just how bone-achingly cold it was here. Kai had forgotten a lot of things about the City of Sight, but he had never forgotten the kindness of the woman who stepped from the arched entrance to the tower.
"Hello, Kai," said Anik Sarashina. "It is good to see you again."
"Mistress Sarashina," he said with a short bow. "I hope you will not take this the wrong way, but I cannot say the same."
"No, I expect not,"
she said with a sad but wry smile.
"You never could conceal how much you wanted to be away from this place."
"Yet here I am," said Kai.
The man beside Sarashina took a step forward, his bullish manner more than matched by the rippling haze of belligerence surrounding him. Encased in beetle-black armour, and with the craggy, unforgiving lines of his face concealed by a reflective helm, he wore his power like a mailed fist. He received a rolled parchment from the lead armsman and broke the waxen seal. Satisfied with its contents, he nodded and said,
"Transfer is acknowledged. Kai Zulin is now in the custody of the Black Sentinels."
"Custody? Captain Golovko?"
said Kai, as a group of soldiers in contoured breastplates of burnished obsidian and tapered helms, not unlike an early make of Legiones Astartes armour, emerged from the tower. Each was armed with a long, black-bladed lance, their hafts topped with sparkling crystalline spearheads.
"Yes, Zulin, and it's Major General Golovko now," said the man.
"You've gone up in the world," said Kai. "Were all the senior members of your organization killed in some terrible accident?"
"Kai, one does not begin the healing process with insults," said Tortega.
"Oh, shut up, you bloody imbecile," said Kai. "Just go away, please. Take your precious patriarch skimmer and get out of here. I can't stand to look at you anymore."
"I'm just trying to help,"
said Tortega with a hurt pout.
"Then leave," said Kai. "That's how you can help me best."
Kai felt a soft hand take his arm, and calming energy filled him, easing his barbed thoughts and imparting a measure of serenity he hadn't felt in months.
"It's all right, Chirurgeon Tortega," said Anik Sarashina. "Kai is home, and he is one of us. You have done all that you can, but it is time to let us take care of him."
Tortega nodded curtly and turned on his heel. He paused as though about to say something, then thought the better of it and climbed back into the skimmer. The Castana armsman followed him, and the doors slammed down with a solid clunk. The skimmer spun on its axis and sped away as though eager to be gone.
"What an odious little shit," said Kai, as the skimmer vanished from sight.